Detailed issues like the Black Hawk helicopter flying above prescribed levels and the challenges of visual separation in complex airspace. The third day of testimony is today. The final report on the crash is expected next year. The collision is part of a concerning string of crashes and near misses this year. For Pacifica Radio, I'm Teresa Wersbionska.
Escuchando in Washington and all points beyond. This is Oscar Fernandez, and you're listening to Latino Media Collective here on WPFW 89.3 FM, Washington. El Distrito Colombia here on this Friday, August 1st, 2025. We're also heard on latinomediacollective.com. You can find us on Twitter under the name at @LMC_show, and of course, live on WPFWFM.org. That's WPFWFM.org. Once again, this is Oscar Fernandez, and today on the show, we put the spotlight on U.S. sanctions imposed on various countries and how they end up possibly killing more people than war does. And so joining us on the show today is Silvio Rendon. He's an economist for the Center for Economic and Policy Research. The Center for Economic and Policy Research just conducted a new study entitled Rethink Sanctions, They're Killing as Many People as War Does, which is co-written by Francisco Rodriguez, Mark Weisbrot, and our guest today. Welcome to the show, Silvio Rendon.
My pleasure. Thank you very much for this invite, and all greetings for all your audience. Thank you.
Absolutely. And this would be an interesting conversation because in one form or another, we've spoken about U.S. sanctions on the show, whether it be Venezuela, whether it be Cuba, and even various other parts of Latin America and the Caribbean. But let's begin by quoting Mark Weisbrot, your co-author here, and his recent article for the LA Times, because he says the following, quote, "Broad economic sanctions, most of which are imposed by the U.S. government, kill hundreds of thousands of innocent people each year, disproportionately children." And so last week, the Lancet Global Health Journal published an article that estimated that the number is about 564,000 annually, over a decade. This is comparable to annual deaths around the world from armed conflict. So before we get to any specific cases, could you expand on the general argument being made by Mark in this recent article in the LA Times?
Sure. Okay, what happens is that sanctions deteriorate the health system, deteriorate the economic conditions of the sanctioned country. You get no access to medicines, it deteriorates economic activity, and all of that has an impact on mortality. Okay? Mortality, people die, you know, normally because of accidents, because of disease, because of several reasons. Okay? But what we do is we compare what happens to sanctioned countries compared to countries that were not sanctioned. Okay? In countries that are sanctioned at some point compared to how they were doing before they were sanctioned. And what you can see is that sanctions increase mortality at all ages. Okay? So that's the basic mechanism. Now, this has been studied. This is not our contribution. That's well recognized. What we do is a quantification of that. You know, we take the pyramids of age, you know, the age structure of countries, and we do that in a very disaggregated fashion, in a very granular fashion, so that we take infant mortality, we take mortality for kids, for children, we do that for adolescents, we do that for adults, we do that for older people, okay? And all this age structure is shaken by sanctions. What you can see is that mortality increases at all ages, okay? So now we take a number, we quantify that. And we have, you know, this research is mostly done by economists, but we have some dialogue with what demographers do, because we take seriously the, you know, the age pyramid of each country, which is available data, publicly available data, okay? So we do this study and we do an estimation of that, okay? So once we do this estimation, we quantify what is the effect, what is the, what we call the elasticity or the sensitivity of mortality sanctions. Then we proceed to quantify, okay, these numbers, these rates, what does it mean in human life? Because if we just talk about rates, what's that? You know, it's just a rate of profit, rate of, you know, interest, you know, it's not human, okay? So in order to relate, to communicate our findings, we need to transform that into human lives, which is something I'm struggling with, because ultimately that's the objective of the economy, human lives, okay? Not always we heard that, you know? We hear that we're thinking about the economy as money, making money. No, no, it's human lives. So that's our approach. And what you can see is that once you translate these rates, these increased mortality rates, these little increases, you know, these little increases in these little rates imply lots of human lives, lots of human lives. And it turns out, and we were ourselves surprised to find out that the number was more than half a million per year. And then, you know, I think that was Mark's idea, you know, who was a good communicator, you know, well, all of us try to be. He kind of related that, okay, let's see how many people die in armed conflicts. And it's kind of the same and even more that people are dying by sanctions. So what's the takeaway from this? Well, you think that bombing countries, you know, it's bad, you know, and you think that maybe it's a cleaner way of messing up with countries, you know, or trying to change their behavior is to sanction them. Well, it's not so clean as you used to think, because you kill more people than if you bomb them. Okay? So that's our basic takeaway from here. And now, well, we can keep conversing about that. We can keep talking about that. But now we can think, okay, look, it's not so clean. It's not so nice. It's elegant maybe for some people just to sanction than pushing a bomb button. But it's not, because the consequence of that is loss of life. Okay? So that's our basic point. And you can see that. That's material. That's big in some countries.
Precisely. And it's very consistent with what Mark said in his LA Times article. And in a more perfect world, the media here in the U.S. would be explaining this a lot more clear and a lot more often than it should, because as Mark sort of, and I'm paraphrasing here, what he sort of said there is that economic warfare is not as clear, as obvious, or as well-defined as armed conflict that we could see with our own naked eyes. It's almost done behind closed doors. with secret handshakes and with little to no input by the general public. Now, the use of economic warfare, which is sort of what we're describing here, by the U.S. to punish a country's entire population is not necessarily new nor original. So, for example, as just one example, in the Church Committee hearings of the 1970s, it was revealed that Richard Nixon ordered the CIA to, quote, make the economy scream in Chile to prevent Allende from coming to power or to unseat him. And in your study, you even cite Woodrow Wilson as referring to sanctions as, quote, something more tremendous than war. So although the analysis of this study is based on the last 10 years alone, could you give us a few stats that show how perhaps this form of economic warfare has sort of evolved or maybe become worse, particularly when it comes to medical access? I cited a few old examples of things that happened over 50 years ago, but this sort of economic warfare seems to have evolved and gotten worse.
Yes. Well, here, our colleague Francisco Yonoa, co-author, he's the one who has a big trajectory in studying sanctions. He's Venezuela. He knows very well that, you know. But it's true. I've seen also the data, and you see a spike in sanctions, and you see a massification of the use of sanctions, sometimes for short periods of time. Okay, but that's enough. That's enough to cause, you know, make, you know, a country shake, you know, tremble, you know. So that's enough. There are countries who have, you know, long-lasting history of sanction. I think China is still sanctioned, so to say. But China is big. You see, they can absorb that. But still, even these countries, you know, have an effect, even if you're big, okay? China is not Cuba, you know. You have different sizes, you know, and certainly different effects. Different consequences, you know, because of, you know, history, because of size, countries are different, you know. That's certainly, you know, understood in part of our concerns in the study, because we do control that, okay? But you see an increase, that's true, in not just in sanctions, but in the effect that sanctions have on mortality, okay? So that's something important to bear in mind. And also, you know, a diversification of the type of sanctions. You know, we distinguish, for example, between global sanctions, UN sanctions and unilateral sanctions. Unilateral sanctions is, for example, US sanctions that didn't go through, you know, some vetting by, you know, UN, some international conventions. A country just decided to sanction another country, okay? That's unilateral. There was no coordination with other, you know, bodies, and the reason may be capricious for that sanction, okay? Certainly, in a world, you know, well, you know, in a world of, how would I say, you know, if you have a police, you know, and you don't obey some rules, you know, you have the police, law enforcement, you know. Internationally, you don't have that, okay? So you have the goodwill of countries and tribe negotiations. But sanctioning is an extreme way of doing things, especially if they are unilateral, you see? So that's more like, you know, you can have a policy agenda. It's not necessarily that the country was sanctioned because they did something, you know, terrible. But the problem is, even if they did, who are you sanctioning? Okay, even if the ruler of a country did something bad, say, okay, and these rulers deserve some kind of sanction. You're sanctioning the people who are ruled by this, you know, by this ruler. Okay, so that's kind of what's troublesome about this, disturbing about these, you know, collective sanctions where all the population suffers. And why was I sanctioned? You know, what did I do? So that's kind of like, you know, what's so terrible about this too.
And thank you for bringing up both the UN and the European Union as well, because we have to remind ourselves that sanctions used in this manner is not necessarily exclusive to the United States. It does include the European Union, you know, imposing sanctions on countries like the ones that you just mentioned. And it's important to note that power structure, because it's not like Jamaica, for example, can impose sanctions on the U.S. and negatively harm the U.S. in any way, shape, or form. It's the other way around, more oftenly, the power imposing economic sanctions on the weak. And so, as an example, by the way, in addition to denial of medicine, which you just mentioned, another component that can be found in economic sanctions is the blockade of the necessary infrastructure and spare parts to maintain, for example, drinking water, including electrical systems. So with that in mind, this is one of the first things that popped up in my head when I read the study. Were the economic sanctions in Iraq during the 1990s serves sort of as an example or as a frame of reference to this study? And before you answer that, I want to tell you this, that I vividly remember as far back as 1996, Secretary of State Madeleine Albright, during the Clinton administration, she was interviewed on 60 Minutes, I believe, and they were asking her about the effects that these sanctions were having on children in Iraq. Again, this was during the 1990s. And her answer, I'm paraphrasing here, her answer was to the effect that we know the sanctions are having this effect, but we believe it's worth it. And there was a lot of negative reaction to this statement by Secretary Albright during this time period. And so, again, this is one of the first things that popped up in my head when I was reading this study before Iraq was even mentioned. And so was this a crucial frame of reference in the study?
Well, okay. I should say something, that our study is not specific for one country. It's for the world.
Yeah.
We try to do, you know, we try to single out some countries. But then we said, no, this is just for the world. Because in order to study each case, for example, Venezuela, you're going to ask me about Venezuela soon, you know, but Iraq too, you know. So there are a lot of subtleties because each case is different. Our strategy, especially at the quantitative level, was to say, okay, these are, we're going to take the world as, you know, common. We're going to try to address some singularities of each case, but this is not going to be a case study because there are a lot of case studies. And the case that you mentioned, Iraq, is well documented. Okay, the effect that sanctions had. And at the end, sanctions had little effect. I mean, at the end, it was an invasion, you know? So, you know, it was the whole thing didn't contribute. Okay, it weakened the economy, weakened the people, but it didn't produce any regime change. If you think about that, how they had to do it, okay, it was an invasion. So the whole thing, you know, well, but anyway, so I'm just commenting that from, not from my study, you see? From my study, our study, what I can tell you is that we have a chain of causality. Look, even accidents, you know, if a country is sanctioned, even accidents are more likely to happen. Why? Because infrastructure is not constructed, because there is more insecurity, because security measures are, they cannot afford security measures, and there is more likely that accidents happen. Working accidents, people who work, they are more likely to have these accidents because security measures, security infrastructure, security materials are no longer available for people, okay? So even that is affected. You know, of course, an accident is something, you know, fortuitous, you know, something that happens, you know, allegedly you cannot blame, but the probability of an accident will increase, you see? So still that is ruled by, you know, the general conditions, economic and social conditions that a country has to endure. Okay, so even that is affected. Look, when we, it was my part of what I had to do, had to classify the reasons for people dying. There is a table, you know, for reasons for dying. You can die because of a disease, you can die natural causes, and what natural cause? You can die because of accidents, you can die because, in accidents, there's a whole classification. Traffic accidents, the whole thing, you see? And even traffic accidents can increase. Why? Because streets are not preserved, you know, there's no security, traffic lights don't work so well, people are more anxious, you know. There are a lot of channels. I want to, you know, share this idea with you by which, you know, and they may they look subtle, but they're not so subtle anyway, because that's studied, okay? Whatever is not like, not because something is caused by chance, it means that it's not ruled by some rules, but some laws that govern that process, okay? And that's what we study, you see? So even Iraq, you know, even Iraq with the sanctions has a mortality effect. In the case of Iraq, it's very clear because it was well documented. Because I think, I remember journalists going to hospitals. They said, we don't have medicines, okay? In Iraq was not, you know, how would they say? It was a country that was kind of integrated. You know, they had, they export oil and they had access to all these imports that were part of their culture, it was part of their standard of living. So therefore, it caught them kind of by surprise. So the effect was tremendous and terrible for them. And that's well documented, you know, even at the, how would I say, at the case study level, okay? So that's well known.
Precisely. And I cannot, you know, escape the importance of medicine and access to medical care in this article from Mark Weisbrot and from the study as well, because I feel like a lot of these things, especially again, referencing Iraq again, a lot of the conditions that led to the deaths during the 90s were from preventable diseases, if not for the blockade of the infrastructure that we just mentioned. So in addition to that, based on your findings, how do sanctions affect both adult and infant mortality rates? This is a broad question, but it's a broad question because, again, like I said before earlier, not enough people know about this, the use of these sort of sanctions.
Right. Well, what happens is that the mortality rates in these segments, in these age segments, increase the most. So that's where you have a big sensitivity. And there is something that happens also. You know, you affect children, you affect lots of people. Because typically the pyramids, the age pyramids, you know, you have many of these anxious countries has large young population and infant population. So a rate, you know, applied to that segment, you know, the bottom of the pyramid has more level effects, you know, has affects more lives than in the upper part. Okay? So that's what happened too. You know, when you translate rates in levels, you know, in number of deaths, then, you know, you're going to have more in those age segments. Okay? For older people, you're going to have less effect because it's less likely that people reach those higher age levels, especially in some countries. The age expectancy in many of these countries are kind of like people die younger, so to say. Okay? They don't reach, you know, older ages. So therefore, you know, the level effect there is kind of less. Okay, but it's in the younger population, in the infant population, in the kids population. That's where the effect is huge.
Yeah, and even here in Washington, we could see it in our own eyes with the rising number of migrants from Venezuela coming to this community and various other parts of the country as well. Now, as we said probably earlier, is that the issue of Venezuela is probably unavoidable when it comes to the issue of U.S. sanctions. And in Mark Weisbrot's article in the LA Times, he also said the following, quote, "In Venezuela, the first year of sanctions under the first Trump administration took tens of thousands of lives."
Yeah.
Then things got even worse as the U.S. cut off the country from the international financial system and oil exports, froze billions of dollars of assets, and imposed secondary sanctions, quote unquote, on countries that tried to do business with Venezuela, end quote. To support this point that Mark made, I have a clip here of journalist Abby Martin's interview with UN investigator and human rights rapporteur Alfred Desaias in 2019. Keep that in mind, 2019, on how the U.S. created these conditions. So let's take a listen.
What I told the Human Rights Council is that the financial blockade has had extremely adverse human rights impacts. Obviously, the origin of the current economic crisis is in the fall, the dramatic fall in the price of oil. But normally, you would be able to fix that. A country as wealthy as Venezuela should have been able to borrow money on its enormous natural resources and then would have been able to buy and sell like anybody else. But no, the United States has made sure that because of the threat of enormous penalties to the U.S. Treasury, the banks have been closing the accounts of the Venezuelan government and of the Petróleos of Venezuela. Already in July 2017, Citibank unexpectedly decided, without prior notice and arbitrarily, to close the bank accounts of the Central Bank of Venezuela and the Bank of Venezuela in November 2017. Again, Citibank blocked the transfer for a shipment of more than 300,000 doses of insulin. In November 2017, the company Euroclear retained $1.65 billion that the Venezuelan government had paid for the purpose for the purchase of food and medicine. Citgo, the Venezuelan state oil company based in the U.S., has not been able to transfer its profits outside the United States of America. It needs that money to buy food and medicine. And it is in the neighborhood, I think, by now of $9 or $10 billion that have been withheld. There again, Wells Fargo Bank withheld and canceled payment of $7,500,000 made by Brazil to Venezuela for the sale of electricity. In May 2018, the Venezuelan Minister of People's Power informed that a financial transaction amounting to $7 million for the purchase of dialysis supplies for patients, including children and adolescents, requiring such treatment had been blocked. So you see here the immorality of it, but not only the immorality of it. There is personal criminal liability for the impact of these sanctions.
So again, that was UN investigator and human rights rapporteur Alfred de Zayas in 2019, sort of explaining how the sanctions against Venezuela worked or sort of functioned by the U.S. during that time period. And I underlined 2019 because obviously this was a year before the pandemic. And he even cites how the sanctions affected Venezuela as far back as 2017. So I wonder if you could explain on what Mark described in Venezuela as, quote, the worst depression without a war in world history.
Right. Well, I just want to say that the effects of sanctions on the economy have been terrible. Okay, and there was an increase in mortality as well. Fortunately, however, Venezuela is not one of the countries where mortality was hit the most in the world. Fortunately, why? Because Venezuela has a good health system, relatively speaking. The mortality rates of Venezuela in the first place were already low. So that's not where you see the bulk of, you know, fortunately, of mortality. It did increase mortality. And we report that in the paper, okay? That there was an increase in mortality, like 5,000 deaths, okay, per year as a result of the imposition of sanctions, of which 869 would be children less than 5 years old. So there was an impact, and this is material, okay? But it wasn't as massive, you know, part of this 500,000, fortunately, is not in Venezuela. The effects on Venezuela have been mostly economical, not in mortality. Because remember, this study that we did is for the whole world. In other countries have bigger mortality rates, and therefore the numbers of deaths are bigger than Venezuela. So the impact of sanctions in Venezuela is huge on the economy. It's a big, big impact in terms of deteriorating the economic conditions of the population, creating poverty. Not so much. It does. I don't want to understate that. But it does, the impact is not so much in killing people, although it does kill people, okay? Why? Because in other countries, the effect is bigger. Who have more precarious systems, who have less access to health, you know, Venezuela fortunately does have a system, okay? Does have a social network, which was created historically, okay? And was, you know, there was redistribution going on and people had access to that. However, it did have an impact. So I want to clarify that, you know, to give the correct message, you know. Look, because if we don't do that, you know, then our study, some people would question our study. And I want to be very precise about what we say and what we don't say. Okay, I'm talking about the study about mortality and the effect. I repeat, there is an effect in mortality. However, Venezuela is not the country that was hit the most. Okay, so just to make the comment correct.
No, and we certainly need that clarification. And since we're still on the issue of health here, again, what I played to you was before the pandemic. And so I'm curious to know if the pandemic of 2020 plays any part or is even at the very least under consideration during the course of this study.
No, we did that pre-pandemic because the pandemic changed lots of things. We're talking about a study that lasted 20 years, and we wanted to do that under more regular conditions. Now, under the pandemic, you know, it remains to be seen, you know, how Venezuela handled the pandemic. And, well, they managed to have their network to access to vaccines. You know, the system kind of did the job, like in many countries, fortunately, in the area. But where I come from Peru, you know, I can tell you that at the beginning of the pandemic killed a lot of people. It was very sad. And then the health system reacted and it managed to, you know, to cope with that. But there was a delay, and that delay was fatal, you know. In Ecuador, for example, all those delays killed a lot of people in their health system. And that has to do with the whole historical structure, you know, of the country. Some other countries reacted better in prevention, in declaring first, you know, the lockdowns and all that. But that's very specific. I don't want to get into that so much because it deviates from the objective, you know, of the purpose of our research.
Yeah, I understand. And you're right. There were a lot of early horror stories in the first weeks of the pandemic coming from Ecuador. But again, it's not a monolithic society, Latin America, and that includes its economies and medical infrastructure as well. So we're going to take a break right here. We're speaking with Silvio Rendon. He's an economist for the Center for Economic and Policy Research. The recent study by the Center for Economic and Policy Research is entitled Rethink Sanctions. They're Killing as Many People as War Does. This is the Latino Media Collective here on WPFW 89.3 FM, Washington. We're going to take a quick break right here. Back with more in a minute. Stay tuned.
Creyera en la locura de la garganta del sinsonte, si no creyera que en el monte se esconde el trino y la pavura, si no creyera en la balanza, en la razón del equilibrio. Si no creyera en el delirio, si no creyera en la esperanza, si no creyera en lo que agencio, si no creyera en mi camino, si no creyera en mi sonido, si no creyera en mi silencio, ay, qué cosa fuera la masa sin cantera, un amasijo hecho de cuerdas y tendones, un revoltijo de carne con madera, un instrumento sin mejores pretensiones, de lucecitas montadas para escena, qué cosa fuera corazón, qué cosa fuera. Qué cosa fuera la masa sin cantera, un testaferro del traidor de los aplausos, un servidor de pasado en copa nueva, un eternizador de dioses del ocaso, júbilo hervido con trapo y lentejuela. Qué cosa fuera corazón, qué cosa fuera la masa sin cantera. Si no creyera en lo más duro, si no creyera en el deseo, si no creyera en lo que creo, si no creyera en algo puro, si no creyera en cada herida, si no creyera en lo que rompe, si no creyera en lo que esconde, hacerse hermano de la vida. Si no creyera en quien me escucha, si no creyera en lo que duele, si no creyera en lo que quede, si no creyera
en lo que lucha. Ay, qué cosa fuera la masa sin cantera, un amasijo hecho de cuerdas y tendones, un revoltijo de carne con madera, un instrumento sin mejores pretensiones, de lucecitas montadas para escena. Qué cosa fuera, corazón, qué cosa fuera, qué cosa fuera la masa sin cantera.
That was Mercedes Sosa, and you're listening to Latino Media Collective here on WPFW 89.3 FM, Washington. Reminding everyone, you can also follow us on latinomediacollective.com. You can also find us on Twitter under the name at LMC underscore show. That is at LMC underscore show. And of course, live on WPFWFM.org. That's WPFWFM.org. Once again, this is Oscar Fernandez, and we're speaking about the importance of how sanctions can kill, on how economic sanctions can kill. We have Silvio Rendon, who's an economist for the Center for Economic and Policy Research. The recent study by the Center for Economic and Policy Research is entitled Rethink Sanctions, They're Killing As Many People as War Does. So I wonder if you could explain to us from this study, if you could explain to us how these economic sanctions violate U.S. law. Now, a lot of publications often point out how U.S. sanctions violates international law, but I don't think it's mentioned often enough how it violates U.S. law, and it's something that should be taken into account, along with a lot of other things that we mentioned during the course of this conversation.
Right. Well, I'm less of a... This is deep water for me because I'm more an economist than a legal expert, you know, and I respect a lot, you know, people's trainings, which I don't have in that. But I can make you an intuitive comment about that, which is that we see, a big effect of unilateral sanctions on mortality. Huge, okay? And now, from just an intuitive comment that I can tell you without trying to, you know, play, you know, like a legal expert, you know, pretend to be a legal expert. What I can tell you is that in the U.S., especially in the last administration, you have seen a deterioration of the rule of law. Looks like, you know, we are in a mode in which it doesn't matter, you know, and the guy who, you know, won the election can do whatever he wants and, you know, can just get away with that. There are historical events where that happened in the past, and sanctions are not exceptions to that. But the levels that we are seeing these days, we haven't seen that before. Okay, this lack of respect for the rule of law, some codes, some kind of like paying attention to that. Looks like, and it's also interesting because, well, if you see retrospective, when you have power, you manage to impose your power and you dress up as a legal, in legal terms. Okay, so it doesn't look like you violated the law, but you did. Or you find a twist, okay, to make it look legal. Okay, so that you can see over history. There is a famous quote by Charlie Luciano. And he said, you know, if I had to do, now I'm old, you know, when he was old, he said, but if I had to do everything from the beginning again, I would do everything legal. I just need to know the law and I would do everything what I did, but legally. You see? So even, you know, a gangster who knows how to use the law in his favor can get away with those things. Okay? So this thing about legal, illegal, yes. I would be careful because there are legal things that are not fair and they are imposed and they look legal, but they are actually not. But and when you are able to defend your right, it's too late. They already deported you out, you know, and we've seen a lot of those things, you know, right now with deportation. I'm changing subject probably, but it's unavoidable to talk about, you know, how, you know, this border between legal and illegal, you know, the laws can be violated in a legal fashion. You know, you have rights, but what are you going to do about it? If you five guys just, you know, handcuff you, there's nothing you can do. And you are legal. You have your right. They violated the law. When you open up your mouth, when, you know, you're able to say something and move freely, you are in El Salvador, you know, in Secot.
Exactly, yeah.
You know, so it's too late for you to defend your rights. So that's my intuitive comment that I can give you as an informed citizen.
No, and I don't blame you because we are sort of in a moment of sort of de-evolution when it comes to the rule of law in the U.S. And that happens even before we even get to the conversation of sanctions abroad. And, you know, since we're talking now in layman's terms, I feel like I need to point out something that I always point out when it comes to sanctions when I'm talking about other subject matter. And that is the fact that a lot of these sanctions, if not all of them, most of them, are based on lies. And as an example of that, when I looked at your study, one of the references I saw was from former U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo during the first Trump administration. And the title of this was Mike Pompeo Discusses Cuba's Role in Venezuela. I'll be honest with you, I only went into the first two paragraphs and I couldn't read any more because it was just full of nonsense, lies, and things that have little to anything to do with any form of justifications to impose any sanctions on Cuba, Venezuela, or Grenada, or anywhere else in the world. And so in layman's terms, I mean, is one of the purposes here is to point out, was one of the purposes of this work was to point out the fact that, hey, a lot of this is just based on falsehoods and lies on countries or stereotypical beliefs that have nothing to do with economic and political realities and everything to do with what I get the feeling of is just punitive punishment on a general population abroad.
Well, that is related with what we spoke before, what's legal and illegal. You know, let me give you an example that I'm sure that your audience would relate. I get stopped by a cop because the cop said that I was speeding and I don't like my ticket. I go, you know, to the court, the traffic court. But you know what happens? You know, the police says A, you say B, and the judge believes the police. So it's A. So now A becomes a truth. It's no longer a version. You know, if the judge believes what the police said, he doesn't believe you, what you said. You know, now the statement by the police becomes a legal truth, and that's it. You see? So I may be right, or maybe, you know, just not to be, you know, maybe the police make a mistake. Let's put it nicely, okay? But the version that goes, you know, absorbs the legal aura of, you know, and gets blessed with that statement of being called the truth is that. It's no longer a version. Well, with sanctions, you can say something like that happens. You know, all that you see, you say, oh, it's lies, you say. No, because who said that? You see, it says something with authority, right? Nobody questions that, you know? So that authority makes that statement that is maybe factually incorrect, false, but that's a truth now, legal truth that is, you know, supported by a whole system, by the country, you know, it's an authority. Whatever the president says now, it's like a truth, even though it's more, you know, but it's a truth, you see, because of who said that, you see? Now, fortunately, this is a democracy. It's not a kingdom, you know? And nobody's above the law. That's the whole thing. And we believe in those values, okay? These are universal values that are human, you know, accomplishments, you know, since the French Revolution, the American Revolution, you know, I don't want to romanticize any of this process because Haiti, you know, had to pay, you know, debts for its independence and had to, you know, be imposed by, you know, liberal France and et cetera. I don't want to romanticize. But in terms of values, these are important values that we use to relate to each other, okay, in civilized society, you know, in a community. So it's important to bear that in mind, okay? In the same, it applies for sanctions. You know, it may read something, you know, and I'm sanctioning you because of that. But wait a second, you know, that's not the end of it. You know, history keeps going. It doesn't end. Some people believed, you know, in the late 80s that history came to an end. No, it kept going. You see, it kept going. It keeps going. And we keep, you know, renewing our way of thinking. You know, civil rights was a big accomplishment. It was illegal before, you know, that people sit in the same bus, you know, regardless of their race. Well, that was illegal. Now it's legal. It was illegal that people married because if they had different races, now it's legal. You see, society changed for the better, okay? Hopefully. We are at least, you know, people who share these values We are trying to make that happen with our research, with our communication to the community, with our appealing to reason, you know? So that's my best comment about that.
With this social media age and the modern means of communications that we have, where we can see armed conflicts in real time in this day and age, where we can actually see bullets flying in real time, as an economist, do you find it frustrating or hard to raise more awareness to the issues that are presented in a story like this? You know, whether it be this particular country or this particular region, you know, would you characterize it as frustrating or just sort of a state of bewilderment with regards to trying to explain to people how economic warfare, you know, how can we present it in a way that people will have a greater understanding or at the very least have a greater degree of urgency as to how these sanctions affect people?
Well, I feel some frustration, but I always try to emphasize hope. Okay, I try to emphasize hope, and I try to give the message that whatever is happening can change. Whatever is happening that is bad can change. This is time where we need to give hope to each other because things are so bad, and this being it's been a very hostile takeover by this new administration in a very aggressive, very, how would I say, you know, something that is not what the U.S. wanted to be, okay? The U.S. wanted to be a different United States, you know, inclusive, you know, with civil rights, with all communities, regardless of their race, their gender, their orientation, you know, trying to be part of this big community, you know, and give a contribution to humankind that is superior than the history of this country, the bad history. You know, we try to emphasize the good things that this country contributed. So I'm always trying to give a message of hope that things can change, that countries can review. You see this historical, when you review history, you see, well, slavery was bad, okay? So it has to be recognized that there was a process that was negative to this country, that the sequels of that historical process are still there, okay? And we need to, as a society, we need to be aware of that, and we need to change that for the better. And slavery doesn't just affect, you know, African Americans, it affects all of us. Because we have to make the problems of each community the problems of everybody, okay? So now, for example, Latino community is facing all these challenges with deportations, you know? And like, this is our people. This is our people. It's not, I don't believe, you know, and I don't respect people who say, oh, I'm one of the good ones that supports these deportations because now I am a well-behaved guy who did it better and whatever, you know? I don't like this psychology. I don't respect that kind of thing. So I'm more for, you know, like an equitable type of attitude towards everybody. And Sanchez is part of that, you know. It's an abuse of power. And it hurts the most vulnerable people, those guys who didn't do that. It doesn't hurt the rulers. It hurts the normal people. So that's kind of my approach to that. So, and as you mentioned me as an economist. Well, sometimes people think that the economists should think about, you know, rates of return, money, and all that. And it's frustrating. What frustrates me is when people try to use their knowledge to fool people.
Yes.
Okay. So that's what, you know, and we are no longer in the times where we, you know, were impressed by little mirrors, you know, like, you know, and the conquerors can impress and buy our islands with, you know, little things like that. I come from Peru, you know, and I respect my history. And we're not in the times where we're gonna sell our territory just for, you know, little mirrors that has a nice glance, and we think that that's the way to go. I like to use knowledge for the change, to change society. I want to use whatever I had the privilege to learn to make people aware of things that should need change. And Sanchez was, for me, a great opportunity to work with two experts like Mark and Francisco, colleagues, you know, and contribute with them. So that's the way I want to use science, social sciences, as a means of liberation. It's a means of making things right. That's my approach.
I appreciate the optimism because in Mark's article, he sort of presents that towards the end because he cites the CIA's formal post-9/11 torture program, which included waterboarding, which was ended by executive order in 2019 after public exposure and considerable opposition. This is why I wanted to have you on the show today so people can understand at the very least, or at the very least, have greater awareness to how sanctions can harm a general population and how it can even kill as well. And so Mark says almost towards the end, the biggest advantage of sanctions for the policymakers who use them is the invincibility of their toll. But at the same time, Mark ends it by saying that that is also their Achilles heel, because when the economic violence of broad sanctions becomes more widely known, they will be indefensible and no longer politically sustainable. We can only hope that by more studies like yours, that that would happen and that people will have greater understanding of how U.S. sanctions work in some of the places that we mentioned during the course of this conversation. Now, obviously, there's a lot from this study that people need to look at, I would say. But in the few minutes that we have left, I'm curious to know if there are other issues or other components of this study that we haven't addressed yet that you feel that needs to be pointed out in this conversation as well.
Well, yes. Maybe I can mention something, you know, maybe a detail, but like the population in the world is aging. You know, the pyramids are changing. Like 50 years ago, there were more people at the bottom, you know, like younger people, you know, and fewer older. And that mix is changing in the whole world. Very notoriously. So increasingly sanctions affect older populations, affect more the elderly, relatively speaking. It does still affect more the children because of what I explained before, but because population is changing, you know, the age profiles, okay, the age profiles are changing for the population, it's relatively affecting more older people because of that pattern. That's interesting. That's a demographic pattern that is changing, okay, that is interesting to keep in mind for future sanctions, okay? For future studies like this or for policy action. Now, our hope is that countries are aware and they don't consider sanctions a clean way of making policy changes, okay? People are aware that sanctions kills as many people as wars, as armed conflicts. So it's not so palatable anymore for politicians to push that button, okay? So they have to think twice before doing that because the consequences cannot be so disattached from their action, okay? When things are indirect, they can get away with that, okay? And they can blame somebody else because the causality gets lost in the chain of, you know, of cause and effect. But if you build a direct consequence, cause-effect type of connection, then they cannot get away so easily. The responsibility is more direct, and that's what we hope to accomplish too.
Absolutely. And I just want to iterate something that we said in the first half of the conversation, that it's not like Cambodia or Fiji can impose sanctions on the U.S. or on the European Union and have the same effect that those sanctions would have on those countries. It is essentially the rich versus the poor with regards to the countries. And it's mostly the global South that's been suffering as a result. And so I want to bring that up there because, again, one of the reasons we're having this conversation is to raise greater awareness to the importance of economic sanctions, whether they come from the U.S., the U.N., the European Union, or otherwise. And this is also why we're going to create a link to this article so people can have a greater understanding of what we've been discussing today. And so in the meantime, we've been speaking with Silvio Rendon. He's an economist for the Center for Economic and Policy Research. The CEPR study is entitled Rethink Sanctions, They're Killing as Many People as War Does, which is co-written by Mark Weisbrot and Francisco Rodriguez. In the meantime, Silvio Rendon, it's been a pleasure and an honor. Thank you very much for being on the show with us.
My pleasure. Thank you very much and greetings to your audience. Stay tight. Persist.
Absolutely. And with that said, that is it for today's show. We want to remind everyone you can follow us on latinomediacollector.com. You can also follow us on Twitter under the name @LMC_show. That is @LMC_show. And of course, live on WPFWFM.org. That's WPFWFM.org. Once again, this is Oscar Fernandez saying thank you very much, everyone, for listening to the show. That's it for today's show. Adios. Nos vemos. Ciao.
for WPFW News in Washington and WBAI in New York, I'm Sue Goodwin. Today is Friday, August 1st. Here are some headlines. Steve Witkoff, U.S. Special Envoy to the Middle East, today visited a controversial aid distribution site in Gaza, operated by the U.S. and Israel-backed Gaza Humanitarian Foundation. Witkoff said the purpose of the trip was to better understand the humanitarian situation in Gaza and relay that information back to Donald Trump. The visit comes as the United Nations reports over 1,300 Palestinians have been killed trying to access food since Israel barred the United Nations and NGOs from distributing aid in Gaza. The majority of those killed were at GHF sites. And Human Rights Watch said in a report released today that the killing of Palestinians seeking food in the Gaza Strip are serious violations of international law and war crimes. Human Rights Watch described the sites as death traps that had become the scene of regular bloodbaths.
We were walking on the road that the Israeli military told us to walk on to get to the aid distribution site, and they started shooting at us from
In more news, a federal judge in San Francisco yesterday blocked, for now, the Trump administration from ending temporary protected status for citizens of Honduras, Nicaragua, and Nepal. The decision postpones the terminations until November and affects about 60,000 immigrants. Hondurans and Nicaraguans were granted TPS for the first time in 1999 after Hurricane Mitch caused widespread destruction. Nepal was added after a devastating earthquake in 2015. In her ruling, Judge Thomas chided the actions of the Trump administration while noting that immigrants came to the U.S. seeking protection. Thomas wrote, quote, "Instead, they are told to atone for their race, leave because of their names, and purify their blood. The court disagrees," close quote. And the Smithsonian Institution's National Museum of American History removed an exhibit this month referencing President Trump's two impeachments. The Smithsonian said it restored the exhibition to an earlier version, which notes that, quote, "only three presidents have seriously faced removal," close quote. After the story was published in the Washington Post, the Smithsonian said a future and updated exhibit will include all impeachments. In March, President Trump signed an executive order targeting the Smithsonian Institution, aiming to remove what he considers improper ideology from its museums, education centers, and research facilities. Asked about the removal of references to Trump's impeachment, a White House spokesperson said in a statement, quote, "The Trump administration will continue to ensure that the Smithsonian